And it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use from the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy, because you never know when you might have something to write down, an address, a date, a web page, something you want to look up later on, some place to support a movement. Let's start out with this announcement of September 19th through the 21st. Starts tomorrow. The fall campout will be happening at the Book Cliffs, a weekend of stories and connecting with the land. The Utah Tar Sands Resistance brought us this news on the Earth First Newswire. The Utah Tar Sands Resistance and Friends will be hosting a fall camp September 19th through the 21st out in the Book Cliffs. It will be a time for folks from the Uinta Basin, Moab, Grand Junction, and other surrounding areas to meet, visit the land, and share stories. Anyway, they'll have a whole lot of fun out there. You should probably be pretty close by now. They should have announced their campsite by now, but it will be in the PR Springs area. So they'll post signs so that everybody can easily find it out there. Breakfast and dinners will be provided. Bring your own lunches and snacks. If you want to figure it out, send an email to tarsandsresist@riseup.net. So, anyway, I did look on the Earth First Newswire. I didn't see any updates to this one, anyway. That's the last you're going to hear about that. Upcoming here in Santa Cruz, the Mattole Forest Defenders Benefit Dinner will be happening Saturday, September 27th at 6 p.m. A sliding scale donation of $10 to $20 will be requested. This will take place at the Live Oak Grange, 1900 17th Avenue in Santa Cruz. That's just north of Capitola Road, between Capitola Road and the freeway. What you're in for, a vegetarian dinner with India Joe and local cooks. There will be presentations by Mattole Forest Defenders, a live acoustic music variety show, including such performers as Pale Robin, Burlwood, and others to be announced, and a local artist's print sale. Come out and listen to stories about the inspiring actions that forest defenders in Humboldt County have taken to protect old-growth and never-before-logged forest in the Mattole River watershed from Humboldt Redwood Company's greenwashed FSC-certified logging plans. All proceeds from this event will go to the forest defenders, who are currently maintaining a logging road blockade and a tree sit in a very remote region. They are also requesting donations of rain gear, non-perishable food, but cans are too heavy. I'm not sure what the non-perishable food that isn't in a can. Well, maybe pasta. Large and small backpacks and climbing gear donations may be brought to the event and are very appreciated. For more information, go to www.saveancientforest.org. You could also visit www.redwoodforestdefense.org. That's the Trinidad tree sit. That's related to the Mattole tree sit. And the Santa Cruz event on Saturday, September 17th at 6 p.m. at the Live Oak Grange, 1900 17th Avenue in Santa Cruz, Bring Some Money, is hosted by Santa Cruz Forest Keepers. You can visit their webpage at www.saveuppercampus.org. And Salmon Run for Rivers is looking for volunteers. Friends of the River is excited to announce the Salmon Run for Rivers on October 25th, 2014. This is the first endurance run from San Francisco to Sacramento to save the salmon and the rivers they depend on. Runners will parallel the path salmon take as they swim in from the ocean through the San Francisco Bay, up the delta and to the rivers that flow into it to reach their spawning grounds. We're running in solidarity with the salmon to celebrate their incredible journey and build support for restoring the rivers they depend on. The Salmon Run for Rivers has three components. The first part will take place on October 25th and is open to the public for registration to run from San Francisco to Sausalito. I hope they go over the bridge. The second part will consist of a group of relay runners who will run the remaining distance to Sacramento. The third part is a public event in Sacramento where runners and supporters will join in delivering a grassroots petition calling on state decision makers to take action to save wild California salmon at the height of the drought. Friends of the Rivers is currently recruiting runners to commit to completing portions of the relay paralleling the migration route of the salmon. They're seeking 12 to 15 supporters to run varying distances from Sausalito to Sacramento, and 5 to 6 supporters to kayak 2 legs of the run crossing the bay. If you are interested in participating, please contact Friends of the River via email at info@friendsoftheriver.org. That's info@friendsoftheriver.org. And you can always visit their website at www.friendsoftheriver.org. And we'll be announcing that again. 5 persons are facing federal charges over a ride through a protected Utah canyon in this story by Jennifer Dobner, editing by Daniel Wallace and Peter Cooney, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Federal prosecutors in Utah filed criminal charges against 5 men who allegedly organized and led an all-terrain vehicle protest ride into a Red Rock Desert Canyon closed to motorized use by federal land managers. About 300 protesters participated in the May ride through Recapture Canyon, where officials are trying to protect numerous Native American archaeological sites, including ancient rock art dwellings and other artifacts. The demonstration near the southeastern Utah community of Blanding was part of a pushback by protesters against federal control of public lands across the West. The 5 men are charged in U.S. District Court with 1 count each of conspiracy and operation of an off-road vehicle on closed public lands. Each misdemeanor charge carries a penalty of up to a year in jail and a $100,000 fine. The initial court appearances are set for October 17th in Salt Lake City. One of those charged, 50-year-old Philip Lyman of Blanding, Utah, is the San Juan County Commissioner. The county has long battled the Bureau of Land Management over trail access and had proposed the establishment of a right-of-way through the canyon in exchange for other property. In 2007, the BLM closed the canyon to motor vehicles after discovering an illegally cut trail and damage to artifact sites that were thought to be about 2,000 years old. No decision has been issued on the county's proposal for a right-of-way. A telephone message for Lyman was not immediately returned. Charging documents allege that beginning in February, Lyman and others conspired to organize and promote the illegal ride by sharing information on social media sites and conducting interviews with media outlets that encouraged members of the public to participate. Prosecutors also contend that all 5 men committed an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy by riding all-terrain vehicles into the canyon's restricted area. At a rally in Blanding before the May ride, Lyman told supporters he was not a proponent of lawbreaking and that no one should feel compelled to ride into restricted areas. He said later he stopped short of riding into the closed area and found on a return visit to the canyon no signs of disturbance or damages. And the Bureau of Land Management let them know that Derby should be cute little hats, not killing contests in this story by Bob Ferris of Cascadia Wild. Most of us think that derbies are funny little hats worn by leprechauns and the father of Mary Poppins. But when you combine coyote or wolf with funny little chapeau, the meaning and association become much less funny. In truth, there is nothing cute or endearing about coyote or wolf derbies, that is, unless you feel that ignorance and fear are attractive traits. So why would a federal agency even consider allowing a misguided group known as Idaho for Wildlife to conduct one of these killing contests as a fundraiser on lands owned by all of us? Yes, this is the same group that was deploying the so-called long-range tactical wolf hunters and offering bounties on wolves in Idaho. And yes, this is the same group that is spreading false information about wolves and disease. And yes, this is the same group that is fighting the other group that hates wolves because they do not tell the truth, but is supported by other groups who hate wolves and spread misinformation, including the group headed by a convicted elk poacher and ironically called Save Our Elk. And the author says, I simply cannot make this stuff up. So when we distill all this down, we have a group that spreads misinformation about wolves wanting to raise money to spread that misinformation by creating a contest based on fear and myths on federal lands owned by all of us during a time in winter when elk and deer, the species they want to protect, are food challenged and most sensitive to human presence and stress. Why does an image of torches and pitchforks pop into my mind? Anyway, before we all die of irony poisoning, please take a moment to give some feedback to the Bureau of Land Management on this matter. And you can do that by going to the webpage www.cascwild.org. That's cascwild.org. And Japan defies the Whaling Commission, vows to resume the Antarctic whale hunt. In this news from Environment News Service, the International Whaling Commission voted last Thursday against Japan's plans to resume scientific whaling in the Antarctic next year, but Japan said it would go ahead regardless. The International Whaling Commission resolution, passed by a 35-20 vote, said Japan should abide by an International Court of Justice ruling that said that its whaling program is illegal because it was not for research purposes. The world's great whales are hunted to near extinction by the early 20th century. An International Whaling Commission moratorium on commercial whaling went into effect in 1986. But since then, roughly 30,400 whales have been killed by Japan and other defiant countries, including Norway and Iceland. We will be providing and submitting a new research plan in the Antarctic Ocean so that we implement research activities starting in 2015, said Joji Morishita, head of Japan's delegation, and all these activities are perfectly in accordance with international law, scientific basis, as well as the ICJ judgment. In the first international summit on whaling since Australia's win, Australian Environment Minister Greg Hunt attempted to lock in the International Court of Justice's decision against Japan's Antarctic kill. Until the ruling, Japan maintained it had the sole authority to decide to take up to 935 minke whales, 50 humpbacks, and 50 fin whales in the Antarctic every year for scientific research. Hunt said the principles of the court's finding that Japan's whale kill was not scientific research should be integrated into the work of the International Whaling Commission. In the words of the court, the highest court in the world speak for themselves, Hunt told the IWC meeting on Monday. Australia is of the view that lethal scientific research is not necessary, Hunt said. Australia backs a resolution by New Zealand to the 89 member countries of the International Whaling Commission, which would restrict member governments' authority to issue permits for scientific whaling until they undergo a full review by the International Whaling Commission. Although the government of Japan has announced that lethal whaling will not be resumed until 2015-2016, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, under the leadership of Sea Shepherd Australia, has adopted the precautionary principle and is preparing the three Sea Shepherd whale defense vessels to once again confront the Japanese whaling fleet in Antarctica, as it has for the past 10 years. During the 2013-14 whaling season, the direct interventions of Sea Shepherd ensured that the whaling fleet fell short of their quota by 74%, saving the lives of 784 whales. Jeff Hansen, director of Sea Shepherd Australia, said the Australian government's successful case against the government of Japan in the International Court of Justice was a monumental victory in the battle against whaling. Although the Japanese whaling fleet is likely to try and circumvent that ruling, the reality is that whaling continues to be unlawful under Australian and international law. Sea Shepherd Australia is committed to the continued defense of the Australian whale sanctuary and upholding of a 2008 Australian federal court ruling that bans whaling in the Australian Antarctic Territory, where most of the whaling takes place, Hansen said. Other conservation groups are pressuring the International Whaling Commission to make Japan drop its whaling program. Modern research techniques make killing whales in the name of science obsolete, said Amy Leslie, head of the World Wildlife Fund's delegation to the IWC. The Whaling Commission is long overdue to adopt reforms that will protect whales from so-called scientific hunts, which are, in reality, a cover for the harvesting of whale meat. We urge the Commission to adopt the criteria described in the ICJ judgment in order to put an end to the commercial hunts that are disguised as scientific research. Icelandic whaling was also the target of a diplomatic demarche on Monday, the opening day of the IWC meeting. The European Union, United States, Australia, Brazil, Israel, New Zealand, Mexico, and Monaco issued a condemnation of Iceland's whale hunts. And here it is. Sea Shepherd announces Operation Icefish. Following Sea Shepherd's victory of saving 784 threatened, endangered, and protected whales during the 2013-14 whaling season, the International Court of Justice delivered a landmark ruling declaring that the Japanese whaling program in the Antarctic is illegal. Shortly thereafter, the Japanese government announced that despite the momentous decision by the highest court in the world, the Japanese whaling fleet will return to the Southern Ocean in the 2014-15 Austral summer season to conduct non-lethal surveying of whales with the intention of resuming full-scale lethal whaling in the 2015-16 season. Sea Shepherd is now preparing its fleet of ships to once again confront the Japanese whale poachers should they decide to resume their illegal whaling operations this coming season. However, if the whale poachers abide by their promise not to kill whales, then Sea Shepherd will take the opportunity to target the illegal fishing of Patagonian and Antarctic toothfish in the Southern Ocean, shifting focus from saving endangered whales to protecting vulnerable fish and the delicate marine ecosystem that they inhabit. Both Patagonian and Arctic toothfish are unique long-lived ice fish species that are particularly vulnerable to overexploitation due to the slowness with which they reach sexual maturity and their high market value. They are distinctive in that they live in Antarctic waters in depths of 300 to 2,500 meters, the coldest waters on Earth. As a result of this freezing habitat, the Antarctic toothfish has evolved antifreeze-like proteins in its tissue, which with limited scientific research, we still know very little about. Illegal fishing of toothfish has shown to have a devastating effect on toothfish populations, leading to collapse and closure of certain fishing areas. Illegal toothfish vessels operate in a law enforcement vacuum created by the legal and logistical challenges they face conventional policing bodies. Poachers constantly rename and reflag vessels by using and switching between shell companies and flags of convenience. Most importantly, illegal toothfish operators exploit the vast remoteness of the Southern Ocean to evade detection, where effective surveillance is lacking. During several of our past Southern Ocean campaigns, we have encountered illegal longlines. It has been on our agenda for many years to intervene against these fishing boats. The illegal and unregulated fishing of Patagonian and Antarctic toothfish needs to be stopped, and Sea Shepherd has the passion and the resources to do so, said Captain Alex Cornelison, Chief Executive Officer for Sea Shepherd Global. Operation Icefish will be the first campaign of its kind using innovative direct action tactics to fill a law enforcement void exploited by illegal toothfish operators. The Bob Barker and the San Simon will leave Hobart, Australia and Wellington, New Zealand, respectively, to shut down illegal toothfish operators in Antarctic waters. The illegal fishing operations will be documented, reported, and confronted. Unlawful fishing gear will be confiscated and disposed of. In the course of Operation Icefish, Sea Shepherd will patrol the Southern Ocean Shadowlands in a bid to make a citizen's arrest of the half-dozen illegal toothfish operators who continue to exploit these vulnerable fish populations outside the full reach of the law, said Captain Peter Hammerstad, Director of Ship Operations for Sea Shepherd Global. Whether it will be whale poachers or toothfish poachers, Sea Shepherd is determined to maintain a spotlight on what is often known as the last frontier, Antarctica's Southern Ocean wilderness, which is of global significance and deserves the utmost protection. There are a few places left in this world with nature on a grand scale, said Jeff Hansen, Managing Director of Sea Shepherd Australia. Show your support and get behind Sea Shepherd in defending the great wilderness of Antarctica's Southern Ocean, and you can do that by visiting their webpage at www.seashepherd.org.au. That's www.seashepherd.org.au. And an oil train opponent's blockade has taken over the tracks at Port Westward in Oregon. And this news from the Earth First Newswire. Climate justice activists, local Clatskanie farmers, and oil train opponents from all over the Columbia country are blockading the tracks that lead to Port Westward on the Columbia River. The blockade consists of a 20-foot-high tripod of steel poles at its apex, occupied by 27-year-old Portland Rising Tide activist Sunny Glover. Any trade movement would risk her life, as would any attempt to remove her from the structure. A banner suspended from the tripod read, Oil, trains, fuel, climate, chaos. She has vowed to stay as long as she is able. Massachusetts-based Global Partnerships oil by rail from the fracking fields of the Bakken Shale to the blockaded facility. From there, it is loaded onto ocean-going vessels bound for West Coast refineries. The facility was constructed with public clean energy loans and tax credits to manufacture ethanol in 2008. The owners declared bankruptcy almost immediately, and in a twist of savage irony, it became a crude oil terminal. Fossil fuels are catastrophically destructive, Glover said. Extraction ravages land, water, and the health of local communities. Transport results with deadly explosions, toxic spills, and dust. And as they are burned, the earth is forced ever deeper into immense climate instability. Fossil fuel production is violence and on an incredibly vast scale. The increase in U.S. oil production in recent years and the consequent rise in oil train traffic has outraged a diversity of groups and communities. Rising tide activists hoping to deter the most severe effects of climate change are demanding a rapid dismantling of fossil fuel infrastructure throughout the region and the world. Residents of areas affected by oil train traffic are horrified by the propensity of Bakken crude trains to derail in fiery explosions. A May 2014 emergency order by the U.S. Department of Transportation describes the train as an imminent hazard. Residents of the patchwork of farms, dikes, and waterways north of Clatskanie are fighting to protect agricultural land and salmon habitat from industrialization. When the crude oil trains began rolling through Columbia County, we had no prior warning, not from the Department of Environmental Quality, not from the Port of St. Helens, not from the county, and not from the state of Oregon, said Nancy Whitney. With the close proximity of our towns, particularly our schools, and considering the track record of crude oil derailments, my fear is that the potential devastation from leakage or explosion could be astronomical, and it will happen unless these trains are stopped. This is the fifth oil train blockade in the Pacific Northwest since June. And this is only the beginning, said Noah Hawkman. We will continue to blockade until it is financially, logistically, and politically untenable for oil trains to threaten climate and communities. And moving to British Columbia, Sacred Headwaters blockade has been established to stop trophy hunters in this story by Rhoda Kwok. The Klabona Keepers, and found on the Earth First Newswire. The Wildlife Defense League has been invited by the Klabona Keepers to blockade the only road providing access to the sacred headwaters in British Columbia. This area is home to numerous species of wildlife, including moose, grizzly bear, black bear, and stone sheep. In recent years, these animals have been exploited by residents' hunters, mainly for trophies. Moose populations have been the most affected due to no bag limits that have precipitated a massive decline in the species. Consequently, the Klabona Keepers and the Wildlife Defense Fund are firm in their conviction that protecting wildlife and safeguarding habitat in the sacred headwaters from exploitation is a pressing priority. The Klabona Keepers, with the support of the Wildlife Defense League, intend to blockade the entrance to the sacred headwaters from non-indigenous and resident trophy hunters. Tahltan hunters will not be blockaded, as the Wildlife Defense League supports their right to live off the land as they have done for thousands of years. Wildlife Defense League member Tommy Knowles stated, "It's taken us 3 days to drive through what feels like the most wild place on Earth. We've seen grizzly bears, black bears, and moose living out their natural lives in this unique habitat. It's disheartening to arrive in the sacred headwaters today knowing that this land is a trophy hunter's paradise, but it feels amazing to be standing in solidarity with the Klabona Keepers to put an end to this exploitation." Not only are the wildlife community that is dependent on them being exploited, but also is the land. This past week, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police surrounded a group of unarmed, peaceful members of the Klabona Keepers. The group was occupying a drill site on the mountain behind this blockade because the company was drilling without consultation or consent on Klabona land. The Klabona Keepers had simply requested that the company, Fire Steel, meet with their elders prior to releasing the drills. However, in a show of disrespect, Fire Steel and the government disregarded that request and arrived by helicopter to remove the drill. They came unannounced and heavily armed. Thereafter, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police prohibited members of the Klebona Keepers from communicating via radio to anyone outside the blockade, cutting off the only means of communication they had with elders and their families in Iskoot to assure them of their safety. They were threatened with arrest if they attempted to use their radios. The situation unfolding in the sacred headwaters is illustrative of the interconnections between these issues, the corporate and political exploitation of land, resources, and animals of this territory, and the communities that rely on them. The Klebona Keepers, with the support of the Wildlife Defense League, are asserting their lawful authority to defend their territories, and both organizations hope that the hunting blockade will raise awareness about the devastating impacts of trophy hunting and will draw attention to corporate and political exploitation of the sacred headwaters. Klebona Keepers is an organization of Tahltan elders and families who occupy and use traditional lands near Iskoot, British Columbia, known as Tlababane, the sacred headwaters of the Stikine, Nass, and Skeena Rivers. And for more information, please visit www.klebonakeepers.org. That's spelled KLABONAKEEPERS. Once again, KLABONAKEEPERS.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every week, except for the next 2 weeks, when I will be out fishing. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update, we have a new broadcaster joining our network, Free Radio Edmonton, which you can find on yegradio@wordpress.com. That's yegradio@wordpress.com. We'll rebroadcast the Earth First Update on 2 p.m. on Saturdays and 10 a.m. on Sundays, and that is Mountain Time. You can also tune in to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, at 9:30 p.m. on Monday nights. I believe that's also Mountain Time. The Earth First Update is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz at 9 p.m. on Thursday nights. You can listen to a rebroadcast at 3 p.m. on Friday. Or you could go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net, where you can listen online or download the Earth First Update. And I'd like to add that radioforall.net is in dire need of donations. So go to their webpage, www.radioforall.net, and click on the little banner at the top and make sure that radioforall.net stays on the internet. They're a vital source for sharing radio programs among independent producers and free and pirate radio stations worldwide. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update, except it's going to be 3 weeks from now.